Blog Talk Radio.
All right, for some reason, no introductory music today. Welcome to Yaron Brooks Show, another episode of our Yaron's News Briefing. This is episode number 5. Thank you for joining me. I know these are now daily, and it's quite something to keep, to listen to me on a daily basis. Not sure what to make of that exactly. All right, I've got a couple of things really coming out of yesterday's show. I hope some of you listened to yesterday's show, and you have the context for what I want to discuss today. And really, the main thing, so I want to start off with this discussion that I started yesterday about the stock market and Trump, that is Trump taking credit for the stock market performance. And I think what shocked me is really the response I got from that, which was just really unbelievable. Before that, let me remind you can call in 347-324-3075, 347-324-3075. You press 1 when you get a line so that I know you want to ask a question. Feel free to call me and challenge me, right? People are challenging me all over Facebook. Call up and challenge me in person. That would be even more interesting. So I put up yesterday on Facebook a graph. Somebody, I think on here, one of the chats on here, put up a graph that basically allows you to look at the Dow Jones Industrials performance by president. So you can actually sort by president, and it gives you a graph for each president. And you can see which presidents have been particularly good in terms of stock market performance and which presidents have not done so well in terms of stock market performance. And I posted this, and this is what I wrote. I wrote, sold by president, and you will see that Bill Clinton was best president in history based on stock market returns. But of course, this is an awful measure of presidential performance. The fact that Trump can't stop talking about it just shows his ignorance. I've since added, parentheses, or should I say his marketing savvy, given that he assumes his audience is ignorant. So anyway, I think if you read that, and maybe you have to read it more than once, it's clear that I'm not suggesting Bill Clinton was the best president in history. I'm suggesting that if you use the measure of stock market return, Bill Clinton looks like the best president in history. I also say this is an awful measure of presidential performance. And just to illustrate the fact that nobody actually reads anything, they just look at you insulted Trump or didn't insult Trump. I get all these comments about, I'm a Clinton lover. I think Clinton's the greatest president in history. I'm crazy. I'm a nutty leftist. And on and on and on. It was just, I don't know if to laugh or be amused, but to be horrified by the state of people's ability to at reading comprehension, just reading a simple paragraph and deciding what actually was said. So that's one aspect to it. The other aspect to it is a lot of people just don't know history. They don't know the history of what happened. So I encourage you to look at the chart. The charts are interesting. The charts are valuable. But the best response I got from a number of people, which I thought is hilarious but also goddamn scary, is people told me that what I was suggesting here was fake news, that this was all fake. Now, wow, right? Now, this data, I have firsthand experience with this data. As somebody who used to work with this data, as a finance professor, somebody who's seen the raw data that's been accumulated from all these data series going back 100 years into the stock market returns, I know how it was accumulated. I touched the data in a sense. I've used it. I've manipulated it. The idea that this is fake news is utterly bizarre and nonsensical. So, the data on stock market returns over the last 100 years is pretty pretty definitive. The other response I got was, oh, no, it wasn't Clinton. It was Gingrich, Contract with America, that caused the stock market increase. Again, I never claimed it was Clinton. I actually said it was a bad measure of presidential performance. But that doesn't matter. Again, nobody actually reads, and reading comprehension is not particularly strong, it seems, in America today. But beyond that, I think I said this yesterday, but let me reinforce this. Presidents do not have a huge impact on the economy or stock market, certainly not in the short run. Maybe in the long run, but certainly not in the short run. I mean, in a fundamental sense, Bill Clinton's economy, yes, was partially because of gridlock resulting from the election of Republicans. So the markets knew that Bill Clinton couldn't do any of the really, really bad stuff he wanted to do. So gridlock, the market thought, was good. But the primary reason the market went up from 1994 until 2000 under Bill Clinton was because American companies were incredibly productive. Technology took off. And a lot of other companies were incredibly productive. And that has more to do with the restructuring of America and the allocation of capital that preceded Bill Clinton. That actually happened in the 1980s that resulted in this. And yeah, to Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich's credit, they did not do anything to screw it up. But all presidents can really do is either get out of the way, and very few of them actually do that, almost none of them, or, you know, so they can get out of the way of business, or they can mess things up. Those are the only two options. They can either get out of the way and add a little bit to the ability of the economy to grow, or they can really screw things up a lot. So if not screwing things up makes you a great president, then yeah, there have been a number of presidents who have not screwed it up too badly from an economic perspective. You know, Ronald Reagan maybe is on the line of not just not screwing up, but actually doing some good, but actually freeing up the economy a little bit, but also just a little bit. Bill Clinton didn't screw up too badly, so you can give him a little bit of credit for that, if that's your standard for great presidents, didn't screw up too badly. George W. Bush did screw up badly, so he would go down from an economics perspective as a bad president. Obama screwed up badly and resulted in economic growth that was meager coming out of the Great Recession. And you could go back and I could score presidents. None of them, not a single president since Calvin Coolidge, would actually score good marks in terms of economics. And Donald Trump is no exception. Donald Trump said no exception. Now, somebody accused me of, hey, Yaron, it's not fair because Bill Clinton had 8 years and Obama, Trump has only done four, 11 months. Absolutely. I wasn't comparing total aggregate return. I was comparing annualized return. But if you look at the first 11 months of a president, the best president in terms of stock market returns in the first 11 months of their presidency, something you can find in this graph if you play around with it, if you're curious, if you don't just use Facebook to lash out, but you actually maybe investigate and think, oh my God, what a concept, think, then you would discover that the president with the best stock market return in their first 11 months as president was FDR. 86.8%. And the number two president with the best stock market return after 11 months of being president was Obama with 30.3%. Trump comes in as number three, followed only by less than 1% by Gerald Ford. I don't know. I don't consider Roosevelt, Obama, or Ford as particularly good presidents. Trump fits right in there. I'd say the first 11 months, given the company he's keeping, don't not bode well for his presidency. Ronald Reagan, in the first 11 months, the stock market went down 7.6%. Ooh, he must have been an awful president. Awful president. All right. Hopefully, we'll see. We've got a couple of callers. But hopefully, I don't have to deal with this again. But using this as a criteria, hopefully I've debunked it now for good. We will see. The actual stock market returns far more complex than who is president. They're determined not primarily by politics, although politics can have an impact on them. It very rarely does, because if it's really bad news, you get big negative events like you got in 08. But all of that was because of policies from years and years and years earlier, going back not just to Bill Clinton, but even before Bill Clinton. And, or positive news, like ultimately the deregulation, the tax policy of Ronald Reagan, which actually ultimately did good. And actually, I think Bill Clinton benefited from. Sometimes the benefits are a decade in the future. They're not instant. All right. We're going to take a couple of these calls. We'll see if they're on this topic or not. What happened to my mouse? There's my mouse. All right. Hi. You're on the Yaron Brook Show. Who's this? Hello?
Hello?
Yes, I can hear you. Speak up.
Oh, sorry. I didn't hear the ding, so I thought didn't know if it was me or not.
It was you.
I was actually calling to talk about the Roy Moore thing, but I guess I could riff off of Trump.
Well, we can move what were you going to talk about? I'm sorry. Say again.
I was just going to give my opinion about why Roy Moore lost, and it had nothing to do with allegations.
I've
been thinking about for a long time.
Well, I'm curious. Tell me, because I'm curious.
Okay, Roy Moore lost because, well, he lost for a couple things. First, he was an awful candidate, and he was backed by Steve Bannon, which has become kind of a cancer lately. But the reason he really lost is because he represents an old school paleo conservative wing of the Republican Party that should have died off a decade ago.
Yeah,
Luther Strange would have beat Doug Jones by 20 points. You can't be an anti-gay marriage Republican in this day and age. You just can't. There's a reason that this latest generation is the most conservative in history, and the reason is because the Republican Party has become increasingly benevolent towards the gay marriage issue, and some even openly supporting it. Because kids have become economically minded, which automatically puts them on the right side of the aisle. But then the new Republicans, like the Freedom Caucus and the Rand Pauls of the world, have kind of secured them. But unfortunately, one of the old guard found themselves in the Senate race thanks to the useless Republican establishment. And this was the first special election loss since Trump was elected because of Beltway rhinos backing antiquated candidates that had no chance of winning and no chance of running. If the Freedom Caucus doesn't take back control of the Hill, 2018 will be ugly.
I agree with you. Now, I don't know enough about Alabama politics to say the Moore would have lost even without the allegations. But there's no question in my mind that Moore was an awful, awful, awful candidate and would have been a horrible senator. He represents all the worst elements in the Republican Party. I think the worst part of it, and I've talked about this on previous shows, was the fact that he ignored the Supreme Court. He ignored the courts when they told him to behave differently. So he was a judge who had no respect for the rule of law. And that would be a basis for me to vote against him. But beyond that, when he ran for judge, he almost lost. I mean, he barely won. Just as a judge in a state that goes Republican by 20 to 30 points, Roy Moore barely won his judgeships because of how controversial and backward he is. So I completely agree with you on that. Absolutely, I think the sex allegations just with a nail in his coffin, with a last straw that really sunk him completely. Wow, I made
it didn't
so many metaphors there. It made my head spin. But hey, thanks for calling.
Yeah.
That was an important contribution. Where are you from, by the way? Where are you calling from?
This is Michael. I debated you on Jordan Peterson.
Okay. Hey, Michael. How's it going?
From the Rapture Tribune. I'm sorry to call in with something else.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I agree with you. And you're absolutely right in your analysis. And I think the Republican Party has to wake up and start fielding candidates that young people can get excited about. If you saw how many young people voted for Jones over Moore in that campaign, it was overwhelming. And women was overwhelming. Even among white women, The Jones scored 35%, which you think is a low number, but only 16% of white women voted for Obama. So they went, a lot of white women who are typically Republicans went over. So if you want to win as a Republican, you better get away from this paleo anti-gay marriage, religion above all, no separation state and church. And also combined with that is this economic nationalism, which of course was invented by Pat Buchanan, who is the ultimate paleo conservative, the anti-trade, anti-immigration, not just anti-illegal immigration, but anti-immigration period. So all of that, if you combine all of that, I think that is a death knell for Republicans long-term. The party has to change. And if it doesn't change, if they win, then it's bad for the country. And if they lose, it's bad for the country. But there's a good chance they lose. And what we get is a leftist majority for a long, long time. All right, we got another caller here. Hi, you're on the Yaron Brooks Show. Who's this? 254 area code. Come on, guys.
Oh,
who's there?
Yes, yeah, you're on. Go. Hi, this is Colin from Austin, Texas.
Hey, Colin, how's it going? I love Austin, Texas. One of my favorite places on the planet.
Yeah, I came to see you when you debated a law professor at UT last year.
Okay. Good.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, it was great. I just want to say I think you're absolutely right as far as, you know, the stock market not being a indicator of necessarily a good president. I would actually say a stock market's it may not even be a good indicator of a good economy. It could just be inflation, which I think has been the case of, you know, for a while now. So my question is, do you think that maybe a more accurate measure would be wage growth or low inflation rates or labor participation rates? Or is there maybe a different way to try to figure out if an economy was really good under a president without using the stock market? Because I think stock market is kind of a lousy indicator of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think a stock market should be a factor. You should take into account. Because it does, I think for the most part, stock markets are pretty good measures of future prospects. So what kind of base have you laid for the future? I'm not dismissing stock markets. I actually think stock markets are fairly efficient most of the time. I do think there are periods in which you have to be careful, like the late 90s, maybe in the last 8-9 years because of quantitative easing. You have to be careful of the inflationary effect, as you said, the money flowing in and creating asset bubbles. So I would ignore stock markets. I just think it's one factor. I would also look at, the number of people employed, so the labor participation rate or some other measure other than standard unemployment rate, which I think is a bad measure for a variety of reasons.
Yeah. I agree.
I also think that looking at growth of the private sector is important. That is, GDP is not a great measure. There are other measures but GDP is all we've got, kind of. So GDP growth, but more importantly, the GDP growth is not so much takeout government consumption that's part of GDP growth, and look at private production. And as private production expanded and grown, and how fast has it grown? And then, of course, the real issue, and this is what makes this so difficult, is the comparison is not zero or decline. The comparison should be what would have happened if we had free markets. What would have happened if we had real freedom? And that's impossible to say, right? We can't say that.
Yeah, the unseen is it's hard to quantify.
Yeah, it's
I guess.
The unseen. So things were pretty good under Bill Clinton. Unemployment went down. Labor participation rates reached historical highs. The private economy grew, even if you take into account that some of it was bubbly in the dot-com era. You can take all these different factors into account, but you have to ask yourself, okay, what would that economy have looked like if the government had gotten out of the way completely, if you'd completely deregulated, if you had lowered taxes to flat, you know, very, very low, then the growth rate's unimaginable at that point. And even a slight increase in GDP you know, so a 2% increase in GDP. If you compound it over 50 years, it's massive. I think I saw something like, and don't take me because I don't have the number in front of me, but if we had grown less by like 1% of GDP a year for the last 100 years, we would be poorer than Mexico, right? Something like that.
Wow.
So it's massive. The compounding effect is unbelievable. Yeah. So I was going to ask. I think it's very hard to assess a president based on the performance of the economy, because how do you abstract away other things that you need to abstract away from? Technological revolutions, right? Under Bill Clinton, he was the beneficiary of a technological revolution. Is that because of Bill Clinton? No, it had nothing to do with Bill Clinton. But his economy benefited from it, right?
And also with redistribution policies. I mean, the government can prop up one sector at the expense of lots of other sectors. So that's probably not good.
That's right. Let me make a bold claim. I would say the trade with China is basically responsible for a big chunk of the increased standard of living in the United States over the last 30 years. And that is not captured anywhere in the numbers. And that if not for the growth of developing countries like China and India and other countries, the United States would have over the last 30 years stagnated in terms of total economic growth. Wages would be down, not just flat. And we would have had, we would have been in big trouble. We probably would have had price inflation. I think what's held price inflation back down, has reduced price inflation to almost zero, has been the massive increase in productivity, not in the United States, but in places like China and India, which we have benefited from. So I agree.
And I think
the economy is globally, suddenly you have to look at money supply on a global scale, increased productivity on a global scale. And once you look at increased productivity on a global scale, the numbers are astounding when you look at places like China. So to analyze economics, and this is the thing that really, one of the points I really want to make. People, I mean, I just saw somebody on YouTube say Trump is almost double GDP. I mean, that's so nonsensical. That is just untrue by any measure.
Right.
That you know, and economics is, and GDP is not a great measure to begin with. To make assertions about economics, to have an opinion about how the economy is doing, is not something to be taken lightly. It needs to be thought through. It needs to be analyzed. It needs to be, I mean, I think a professional economist, or as close to a professional economist as you can get without a PhD in economics, my PhD is in finance, am always reluctant and careful to make economic pronouncements, because it's such a complex economic field. It's so difficult. There's so many moving parts. There's so many things happening at once. And yet I find people all over the place that just make economic assertions with no knowledge, no background. And they claim that, you know, they claim the leftist media and all this fake news stuff. And yet they buy into fake news all the time. Just, you know, maybe it's right-wing fake news, not left-wing fake news. They just take the headlines and just run with them. It's mind-boggling.
Right.
One of my goals with this show, I'll just say this and then I'll let you follow up. One of my goals in this show is just to get people to pause and to think and to evaluate and not to jump to conclusions. That news is not obvious. The facts are not obvious. And the analysis is far, far from obvious, particularly in complex issues like foreign policy, like economics, like politics. Just stop for a minute and do a little bit of research, or before you mouth off on some chat, have some self-respect. That's my goal in this. If I can achieve a little bit of that, then I'll be happy.
I was going to say one last quick thing about when you mentioned China. That's one of the things I think is so ridiculous that Trump talks about, and not just Trump, but lots of politicians and even other economists saying that, you know, that somehow China's, you know, they're taking advantage of us, or they're somehow in some huge position of strength over us, which I think it's just the opposite. I think that we've I think we're getting the better end of the deal with now. I mean, I think both sides are benefiting, which is great, but I kind of look at it like China sends us a bunch of stuff and we send them pieces of paper, which I think is
inflating constantly. We're reducing their value constantly.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think we're making off like a bandit in that deal. We're getting all this cheap, great stuff and we're sending them paper. So, I don't think we should be complaining.
It's mind-boggling to me how difficult that is for people to comprehend, because you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right.
Okay. Well, thank you. It's my first time to call in. It was, I'll have to do it some more.
Yeah, absolutely. Look forward to it. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, we've got one more. We're going to take this, and then we'll see if we have time to move on to a different topic. Hi, this is you're on the Iran Book Show. Who's this?
Hi, this is Mike. Am I on?
You are on, Mike.
Hi. I was calling in regards to about the whole Roy Moore, Doug Jones thing. Now, me personally, I think both of them are piece of crap candidates for their own reasons, but just out of curiosity, I watch a lot of your YouTube videos, and I'm fascinated with your view on capitalism. I agree on a lot of your points. I'm also a huge fan of Ben Shapiro, and I know you've probably looked into some of his works. Now, not so much of his religious side, but I believe that a lot of his points on capitalism, you are in line with him. But I was just scrolling through a lot of your videos. I was curious what your particular view on the Doug Jones's idea of abortion is. I was just curious because I know you're more of like a self-interest capitalist kind of guy, but I was just curious, coming from a science end, not from a religious end, but from a science end, now knowing all that we've known from the technology that we have, what your view on that stands for.
I don't think it's a scientific question. I think this is a question of individual rights, and it's a question of what you define as an individual. And I view a fetus inside of a woman as not an individual. It's part of the woman's body, and it's therefore the woman's rights are the only rights that the state, which means the law, should relate to. So, it's a different question. It's a different moral question about is it moral to abort a child, a fetus? And that depends on a lot of different factors that have to do with the specific circumstances of the case. But from a legal perspective, the job of the government is to protect individual rights. And as long as the fetus is not individuated, as long as it's not a separate human being from the mother, then I think abortion has to be legal and must be legal. And it should be left to persuasion. If you don't think abortions are moral, or if you think abortions after a certain point in time should not be moral, then you can persuade. But the state has no business intervening.
So what would be your would you on a two-parter? I was just curious. Would you ever indulge Ben Shapiro in a debate of sorts? Because I know both you and him have engaged in a lot of debates on your own things, and I know he's usually open for all kinds of different debates. I would love to see, because I listen to a variety of people.
You make the second point. I mean, there's discussions in the background about trying to get a debate together with me and Ben Shapiro. There are three problems right now that we face. One is funding. Ben is very expensive. I'm relatively cheap, but he does not speak for free. His rates are very expensive, and very few people are willing to pay to see me and Ben debate the kind of money that Ben requires. A debate like that would probably cost, if you include everything in, somewhere around $25,000 to $30,000. And somebody's going to have to come up with the money. So that's money. And then we need somebody to be willing to sponsor it. We had somebody who was willing to sponsor it, and we could have raised the money. But then the date that both Ben and I were available, this university where we're going to host it, wasn't available. They want spring break. So the combination of finding a sponsor who can raise the money and finding a date, given my busy schedule and Ben Shapiro's busy schedule, has turned out to be impossible so far. But we are working on it. Ben has said he's willing to engage in a debate with me. I'm certainly willing to engage in a debate with Ben. I have a lot of respect for Ben, even though we disagree pretty fundamentally on certain issues. particularly his religious orientation. But also, I think I don't think he goes far enough with his defense of capitalism, and I don't think his definition of capitalism is radical enough. I think I'm more of a radical when it comes to capitalism, and I would include here things like his position on drug legalization, his position on a lot of kind of what you'd call the social issues. I think I'm more radically for freedom than he is. But that's what would make an interesting debate, because we agree on some stuff and we disagree on others. And to define particularly the fundamental disagreements in ethics would be fascinating. So we're working on it. Hopefully it'll happen. It's not going to happen anytime soon. Maybe in the fall. I think our schedules are still not firm for the fall, so we can discuss possibility in the fall. But we really need, if somebody out there listening to this is willing to put up $30,000 to see me and Ben Shapiro debate, I'm sure we could find a venue to do it. So it really is.
Well, I appreciate your time. I appreciate your time very much, sir. Just as a last quick note or whatever.
By the way, the $30,000, I get very little. It's Ben that gets almost all of it.
I agree. Just as a side note, real quick before I let you go, I appreciate your time and answering my question. For future reference, I know he has actually a debate with Sam Harris coming up in a few weeks, and that should be very entertaining to you, because I know Sam Harris is also a fellow atheist. So keep that in mind if you want to watch
definitely interested in that.
In the future.
It would be, although I think Sam, I think the better ways to defend Sam's position that Sam does. But that, it's going to be fascinating, and it's going to be fun to watch. So I look forward to that. Thanks for letting me know about that. Great.
All right,
thanks
no problem
for calling.
Thank you.
Keep listening. All right. Keep calling. Keep getting engaged. It would be great if you guys, the reason I can take less money than Mitch Shapiro is that I'm counting on you guys to contribute on Patreon to support the radio show and these podcasts and everything else that I do. So just a reminder to go to patreon.com. They had this fee change that people were very upset about, that they were changing the fee structure that they were going to do. Well, it turns out that they have reversed that. They're going back to the old fees. So those of you who were upset and didn't want to contribute to Patreon because of the fees, it's now being reversed. So don't worry about that. All right, let's see. I wanted to address one issue quickly. I don't want to go more than another five, six minutes. I've got a bunch of other news stories, but I think I'll just postpone them for tomorrow. I just want to make this point. It relates to the stock market thing and relates to trying to get people to pause and to think. I made a comment yesterday about don't just simply Google something. And somebody sent me, I thought, a thoughtful question about, could I articulate a little bit more about what people should actually do? If they're curious about a topic, how do you investigate it? How do you get objective information about it? And let me just say that the more complex the issue, the harder it is. It's hard to get good information about history, good information, particularly about economics, because the economics field is dominated by various forms of statists. And the ideas expressed about economics are often, ideas that haven't, that, you know, that often bad ideas. They're often wrong ideas. So when I watch people talk about economics on any news channel, Fox, CNN, NPR, Breitbart, I don't know, anything, they're almost always wrong. Their analysis, their economic analysis is almost always wrong. And that's because I think there are very few economists who have a broad understanding of economics and how economics functions and how it works long-term and what is actually going on. And it's hard. I mean, most economists, including myself, and most people don't know exactly what has happened over the last 10 years. The Fed printed a lot of money. It sent out there into the market a lot of money. Where's it all gone? Now, there is some asset inflation, but ultimately you would expect that to go into price inflation. Why hasn't price inflation happened? I have a theory about that. I'm sure other people have theories about it. But nobody knows, as far as I can tell. Nobody knows with definitive statements. And if they do, then it's taken them a lot of thinking and to get to the right answer, right? So it's difficult. Economics is difficult. I say stuff, and I'm worried when I say stuff because I know that there's a good chance I'm wrong because it's hard. So how do you get decent information I think you need to find sources on economics that are semi-reliable, you know, and read widely. So I try to read both the analysis by Austrian economists, a variety of Austrian economists, and some Chicago School economists, which I think particularly John Cochran at the University of Chicago, which I think is always really, really interesting. And I would so I look for blogs of a variety of different economists, and I read them and listen. And then what about and so it's not enough for me just to Google stuff. Google will give me what's popular, but what's popular is Paul Krugman. It's not John Cochran. So it's not enough. If I'm interested in a particular issue, I would, when I was researching about inequality, I wanted to know what does John Cochran say about inequality? What did Kevin Murphy say? What did Nobel Prize laureates, winners in economics say? How do you reconcile what they said with what I know philosophically about the issue? There's a whole array of different views that are interesting, that are worthwhile investigating and researching. If it's just a news story, at the very least, you should look at multiple sources. Look at somebody from the left and somebody from the right and somebody from the middle and try and read the articles and try to see to the extent that you can. Is the writing objective? Are they giving examples that make sense? Is this consistent with the rest of your knowledge? But you can't just take – I mean, it's sad because there is no good news source out there. There is no good source of valid, objective information, and there certainly is no good source of valid, objective analysis. That's what I hope I'm contributing with these daily shows, is at least somewhat daily shows, that I think you'll get some of it. You know, you'll benefit from the work that I do. And I might be wrong on some issues. I'm fine with that. I have no problem being wrong and admitting when I'm wrong when I am. A lot of the people who go on my Facebook page and a lot of people who comment here certainly do have a problem with being wrong. And the way they assert things is so absurdly confident, so absurdly definitive that it's excruciatingly frustrating. But so you got to research. You got to and over time, what you've got to do is assess what news sources seem to be valid and which are not. I mean, I'll give you an example. Well, an example of something a little different. So there's certain issues I know something about. I know something about finance. I know something about the stock market. I know something about financial markets. I mean, I've got a PhD in finance. I've been involved in a hedge fund for 20 years. I know something. I mean, I'm not the world expert on it, but I know something. So when I see what the newspapers write about financial markets and how wrong they get it, just simple stuff, then I go, if this is how wrong they get it on something I really know a lot about, imagine how wrong they get it on all the things that I don't know anything about. So I can't just take their word at it. I actually have to analyze these things. You guys can go out and when you do your research, look at who's publishing the research. So, for example, if you're doing research in immigration, some institutions are known to be anti-immigration. Heritage Foundation, for example. Some institutions are known to be pro-immigration. Cato Institute, for example. Well, read some of the essays from Heritage and read some of the essays from Cato and contrast and compare and maybe try to find if there's anybody neutral out there that actually does science. But if what you do is read an Ann Coulter book and then think you're an expert on immigration because of all the statistics she provides, then you don't know what you're doing. You're not doing research, right? All you do is read Heritage. Now, I read them both. I read the Heritage stuff. I read the Cato stuff. Sometimes I agree with the Cato stuff. Rarely do I agree with the Heritage stuff. But it's interesting to read on immigration, I'm talking about. It's interesting to read because I want that perspective. And some of the data is different than what I think it would be. And I'm surprised by it. Right? Ann Coulter does not do good research. Ann Coulter does absolutely unquestionably biased research. And all you have to do is look at her footnotes. And you look at their methodology, which I have done, which I doubt any of you have done. And if you look at the footnotes and you look at the methodology, the way she tries to estimate the number of illegal immigrants in the United States today, it is bad, bad methodology. That if that methodology was used in a field that you had any understanding of, or in a field that you were professionally involved in, you would be horrified by it. You would denounce it to the world. And that's what I would do with Ann Coulter. I don't have the book in front of me, but Ann Coulter's methodology, time and time again, not to say that there's not value in her book. My point is, I read books that I don't agree with. So, but not to say there's no value in the book, but her methodology and the sources she uses for her statistics are unbelievably biased. She knows exactly what she wants in the beginning, and that's where she goes. And this is the point, you guys, I mean, granted, you're layman, but you're in a difficult position as a layman because it's hard to figure out what's true in the world in which we live in. Donald Trump is right in this sense. There is a lot of fake news out there, but the idea that all the fake news is on the left side is bizarre and just non-objective. There is just as much fake news on the right as there is on the left. Think about the existence of God as the biggest fake news story of the millennium, right? And it's preached by the right constantly with no stop. But Ann Coulter is great on attacking the left, but she is awful on actually doing research. Look at Piketty's research, how bad Piketty's research was. And Piketty is a real economist and he got real data, but you know, people have looked at it. It's bad. It's bad stuff. It's not good numbers. And it's hard to figure that out. So my point is this. It's not that if you come to a conclusion because of reading Ann Coulter's novel, you're a bad person. All I'm saying is think. And before you make definitive statements on a blog, on a Facebook, on a comment section, on any of these things, before you, as a layman, say, look, to the best of my knowledge, this is the facts. But don't get all Uranus full of it because he doesn't agree with me. You know, I've actually done the research. You haven't. So why are you getting so, you know, hyped up? Ann Coulter is not. Again, I'm telling you. Ann Coulter has done biased research. And she has done not zero, absolutely zero firsthand research. Go and look at her citations. They all come from one side of the aisle. They all come from one group of people. And, you know, but if you guys, if you want to be wowed by Ann Coulter, go be wowed by Ann Coulter. But you're going to hate me because me and Ann Coulter have nothing in common. Nothing. Zilch. Zero. I can't stand her. She's wrong on most things. Even when she's right for the wrong reasons. She's right for the wrong reasons. All right. All right. Thank you all for listening. Thank you all for being here while I vent on a variety of different topics and while I hopefully get you to do this. Before writing down anything on social media, sit down and think about whether you really know what you're talking about. Social media would be a lot more fun if people actually wrote about stuff they actually knew something about. All right. Have fun, guys. I'm off. I think I'll be on again tomorrow, same time, same place. Please share. Please let people know that these events are happening, that these things are happening. More and more people I see are listening live. We've got people. We've got to get people to listen to the show after the fact. We've got to drive our numbers up. And don't forget to go to Patreon and support me financially. Have a great night. Have a great life. Talk to you soon. Did that.